Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Professor Michelle Carnes about a book that she published with Chicago University Press. The book is called Medieval Marvels and Fictions in the Latin West and Islamic World. Michelle Carnes is an associate professor of English and History and Philosophy of Science at the University of Notre Dame. She is the author of Imagination, Meditation, and Cognition in the Middle Ages and the editor of the journal Studies in the Age of Chaucer. Michelle, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is such a fascinating book. You talk about there's literature, there's philosophy, there's Western philosophy, Eastern philosophy. And I must say, I'm not very familiar with Islamic philosophy, so I had to read parts more carefully and do a little bit more research. But I was absolutely fascinated by your approach to this topic. But before starting talking about the book, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you became interested in philosophy and literature, and why you decided to write this book?
When I was in grad school at Penn, I became interested in how people in the Middle Ages understood literature according to their own kind of theory of the mind. And it got me taking philosophy classes. And then as I was writing my first book on imagination in medieval religious literature, I just kept coming across Arabic sources that have been translated into Latin. And once I got tenure, literally the day after I got tenure at Stanford, I decided to learn Arabic, and I started on the alphabet so that I could not just read the sources that have been translated into Latin, but read more broadly. And that's continued to be the case. Imagination, the faculty of imagination, has continued to be the central topic of my scholarship, and the concept of imagination in the Latin West was so profoundly formulated by Arabic philosophers like Avicenna and Averroes the kind of topic just pushed me to expand the boundaries that I was working under.
And in the book, you talk about marvels, but let's come up with a definition first. What do you mean by marvel? And then in your first chapter, you discuss how it's interconnected with other fields of natural philosophy. And you discuss many authors from both the Islamic world and also Latin West. I know that we don't have time to go through all those authors, so I'll leave it to you to pick one or two from either Islamic philosophy or Latin West and talk about them as well and see how they define this idea of marvel and its connection with natural philosophy.
So marvels are things that happen in the natural world. They're not supernatural phenomena. They're not miracles, but they're hard to explain. And philosophers approach them with the conviction that they can be understood, but the natural world isn't understood well enough right now in their present to account for, you know, how one person can bewitch someone else, or how a smaller, skinnier person can throw a javelin further. So marvel is a really big category. It's just anything that's hard to explain, but that's fundamentally natural. And philosophers embraced marvels as a way to think through how the natural world operates. So, you know, if, say, you know, Avicenna wanted to understand how prophecy worked, then he would, you know, try to delve into its natural mechanisms so that he could understand how prophecy is possible in the world that we live in. And similarly, with Albertus Magnus or with Thomas Aquinas, you know, when they found something perplexing like fossils, you know, what is a fossil? Like, what accounted for this, like, you know, piece of rock that has the shape of an animal inside of it? Then they didn't know how to explain it, but they thought that the question was interesting, and they should try to think through how nature could make that possible. So they weren't really writing with conviction, saying this is 100% real and this is definitely how it happens. It's more of a conjectural discourse. If these things exist, how might we explain them in a way that helps us understand nature better?
Mm-hmm. And the role of imagination is very, very important in your book. You talk about dreams, visions, and prophecy in creating these marvels. Can you expand on that, please?
So my first book focused on imagination in religious literature, and I noticed that imagination was also used to explain various marvels. If I bewitch you, it's usually a process that begins with my imagination. I want something badly. I imagine it. Say I want to wound you because I'm jealous of you. My imagination communicates itself to your imagination through usually the multiplication of species, like images, basically, that shoot forth from my eyes and connect me to you. And so I act on your imagination in turn, especially if you are susceptible to that kind of influence. And so I was intrigued by how many marvels were explained through the faculty of imagination. And I thought that could probably help us to understand a little bit more about how marvels work, because the conversation about them in scholarship, certainly for Western Europe, has really gotten kind of stuck into this, I think, unhelpful opposition between what's true and what's false. And I think that what's interesting about marvels is that they might be true and they might be false, and mostly they're creative possibilities. Even Alexander Neckam says, even nature uses her own imagination to create marvels. So imagination just helped to explain how marvels could occupy this place between the real and the false as a place of just kind of possibility and conjecture.
And you also come up with two categories for marvel: interior, or we don't. You don't. I don't think you use the word exterior, but anyway, I'll leave it to you to explain. So, what are these two categories? And I'm really interested to know if the second category, where you talk about it, is completely detached from imagination.
So I distinguish interior from exterior marvels in a way that the sources don't. So for interior marvels, I'm thinking about prophecy and dreams and visions, and external marvels, more things like telekinesis, the ability to change the weather, bewitchment. So marvels that act outside of your own body. So like I said, the sources don't actually distinguish these two categories, but it was easier to analyze them if I distinguished them, because nobody was surprised that you could change your own body. You know, I get embarrassed and my cheeks turn red. Obviously, mere thoughts affect our body in this obvious way. Avicenna's example is the wet dream. It's not really surprising that our souls, for medieval philosophers, would affect our bodies. But to affect someone else's body was, you know, a definitely more complicated situation. So it was useful for me to talk about the interior marvel separately, because they also kind of relied on some different mechanisms. But the second category of marvel, things like telekinesis and moving, you know, objects of various sorts, still tends to rely on imagination in order to make that happen. Certainly bewitchment centrally depends on imagination. Obviously, when you're talking about marvels that don't involve people, then you're not really dealing so much with imagination anymore. But for the most part, still, if I affect the external world, I tend to do it through my imagination. Not imagination alone, but usually imagination in concert with desire, with the spirit, the soul, its various powers that give it kind of authority over the material world.
And how did marvel or imagination have impacts or effects on foreign bodies or objects, even in natural, you talk about even natural elements like and weather?
Yeah, so there's a story in Marco Polo about a man who makes a mountain move. There's also a story about, you know, a common story was that obviously you can tell it originates in Arabic philosophy, because it's about a man who can make a camel fall over simply through the power of his imagination. So the most common mechanism to explain that was that there was a theory called the multiplication of species, which held that between the person who's looking and the thing that's seen, there's a kind of constant series of images. This was a way to account for Aristotle's belief that action never happens at a distance. So the species connect, they're invisible, but they connect, you know, two objects, the thing being seen and the seer. So the idea is usually that, you know, like they give the example of a wall that, you know, has a red painting on it. And around the red painting, the white wall can look a little bit red. So Clearly there's some kind of bleeding in your visual field from the red object to the white wall. And they thought this was kind of evidence of the sending off, the emitting of species. So the basic theory for how you would move a mountain is that you would, basically send these images out into the world. Now, Kindi thought that the world was filled with these rays, that they were all, any object was connected with any other through these rays, and that you were basically harnessing this kind of power that started in the heavens by focusing your attention on this other object, and it would give you something of the power that like the cosmos has over individual people. So that way, you know, if you're harnessing this power through your imagination, then you're able to kind of reshape the world in its image. Most clearly, they thought a pregnant woman would be able to change the size, shape, color of her fetus based on what she imagined. But the same principles in play in Bewitchment, where you're just not acting on a body within you, but one that's outside of you.
And in discussions about Marvel, Latin Arabic discussions about Marvel, how were they interrelated? Were there any points of commonalities?
The dominant discourse was definitely the Arabic material. So one of the reasons why I compare these two discussions is because they're both ultimately based in Aristotelian philosophy in a way that like makes them intelligible to one another, even where they differ. They're both kind of playing by the same rules. So, in the 12th century, the Latin West was only just rediscovering Greek philosophy through Arabic translations and commentaries. So it was already Arabic philosophers who had been working with ancient materials and were trying to explain various marvels like a head that prophesies after death, the oracular head, various kind of improbable phenomena. But they approached them specifically as explainable phenomena. And it seems to be that their approach to these kind of natural conundra was extremely influential in the Latin West and helped them kind of spark their own investigations. I mean, Edward Grant, the big authority on natural philosophy, says that natural philosophy begins in the Latin West in the 13th century. I don't know if that's true, but it is definitely more inherited than a homegrown phenomenon. So because this approach to marvels was so interesting to philosophers in the Latin West, they had more and more Arabic works translated into Latin so that they could study more fully what the discussion was that was so much more advanced in Arabic than it would be for a long time in Latin.
And with my next question, I guess we need to define some of the terminology as well. So it's about how natural philosophers considered marvel to be phenomena, and that can have logical possibilities. It's I must say that I found that chapter a bit difficult for myself to understand because I don't have that background in philosophy, and I tried to come up with the best question and as general as possible so that you could expand on that, because you also talk about marvels, if they thought about marvels as a source of truth or not.
Yeah, those are both good questions, and I appreciate your digging through chapters that aren't always super user-friendly. Marvels are logically possible in the sense that there's nothing that makes them impossible, basically. So, God through miracles can do things that the natural world can't normally do. But marvels have to follow the rules of what's possible for the natural world without direct divine intervention. So philosophers talk about them as non-impossibilities. So the natural world could create, a serpent that is able to burn without, to catch on fire without burning up, say. So if any marvel has to be logically possible in order for philosophers to entertain it, but that's not a very strong limitation. So logical, God too can't do anything that's logically impossible according to medieval philosophers. Peter Damian's example is that he can't restore a woman's virginity because that would just be, that would like break the rules. He can, make nature work differently than it normally does, but he's also hindered by logical, like the constraints of what's logically possible. So you have everything that's naturally possible. And then you have logical possibility, which is a kind of species of that. Marvels are definitely linked to the kind of a search for truth among philosophers. Aristotle's contention was that anything that makes us marvel or wonder provokes inquiry. And so that's what philosophers always start with, in his view. Philosophers begin with something they don't understand, they marvel at it, and then they try to explain it. So there is a kind of underlying desire to understand the truth of the world without really depending on whether a particular marvel itself is true. You know, they talk about the same marvels over the ages, like a woman who's menstruating can stain a mirror. If she looks into a new mirror, she's going to stain it with a reddish hue. That was in Aristotle, but that example is used by Isidore. It's used for many centuries afterwards. So they're not so invested in the particular truth of any one marvel, but inquiring into marvels generally will help you understand the natural world better in a way that is going to bring you closer to the truth.
And what was the role of poets or literature in helping philosophers define this marvel as a creative force?
Yeah, I thought that was really fascinating. The way that philosophers keep quoting poets was really surprising to me. To go back to marvels, when Albertus Magnus is talking about them, he talks about Medusa and how she could fossilize people. And that for him is, and he says it's a fable. He doesn't think it's true, but it's useful to him because it helps him conceptualize these kind of sometimes outlandish possibilities and to think through how they might actually operate in the natural world. So that's one of the things I'm most invested in the book is showing that marvels aren't truth claims. They can be conjectural, they can be hypothetical, and philosophers can just ponder how they might work. And so poetry in that sense can help just widen the field of what marvels might be and how they might kind of resonate in the world. And Aristotle, when he said that philosophers begin with wonder, he said that poets also depend on wonder. They don't try to explain it away, but they try to inculcate it. So he thought that philosophers and poets were similarly invested in marvels, and they draw on the same marvels all the time. And that was one of the puzzles that got me writing this book. I was not sure what to make of the fact that marvels become kind of ubiquitous in literature and philosophy at the same time. And, you know, literature is supposed to deal with things that are made up and philosophy is supposed to deal with things that are true. And how can marvels, even the same marvels, be so central in both discussions? And ultimately, you know, what I was looking for is a way for like poetry and philosophy to have the same definition of marvels. And that's why I talk about them as creative possibilities. Obviously, there's some differences in the discussions between philosophers and poets, but at the bottom line is the same, that marvels are non-impossibilities that, you know, spark interest and inquiry and test people, their knowledge, their devotion to someone else in ways that are surprisingly similar.
And one of the most fascinating parts of your book was your discussion about travel writing and how factual and imaginary geographies were described, and they kind of created a form of uncertainty regarding what's real or what's unreal. Can you talk about this chapter, please?
Yeah. I had always kind of avoided travel literature, but it was sort of inevitable that I would need to talk about it. So, you know, travel literature in some ways gestures at its own reliability. It tells you, you know, you can get from one country to another in 3 days if you're walking, but if you take this other route, it's going to take you, you know, 4 months. And, you know, they're very precise about distances and where one country is relative to another. And sometimes it's accurate, but at the same time, they talk about people with three heads and they claim to have seen them. And so ultimately I thought it was useful to kind of think of travel literature as creating a spectrum where there are just straight up facts that are still considered to be facts about the you know, the geographical world. And then there are stories that the writers had heard about for centuries in their own lives, of course, for their whole lives, and were, you know, they needed to account for those too. And so it seems to me that travel literature is really invested in the extraordinariness of the world. The world is the greatest marvel. And, you know, you didn't want to foreclose possibilities. So it's not like they're lying. They're just saying, you know, the natural world there's is full of marvels. We don't know what they all are. And so let's like explore, you know, outlandish possibilities alongside more clearer facts. And, you know, leave the reader in this position where they don't really know where whether everything is true or not. Like, it's not like you can read travel literature and say, for sure, you know, this is true and this is false. And which is why I think it's funny that editors so often with medieval travel literature now have these footnotes explaining how this is false or this is true. And maybe we can explain this claim this way, because I just don't think it's something that the medieval writers really care that much about. I think they're presenting the reader with all sorts of kind of exciting stories and giving the reader kind of permission to think about whether they're real without really coming to a firm conclusion one way or the other.
And what was the role of marvels in romance literature and the way marvels helped create this state of, again, uncertainty about lovers, unfaithfulness, which is, I guess, it was a big theme in medieval literature. And again, you have a lot of examples. It would be great if we could talk about one of the examples that you bring up in the book.
Great. So the role of marvels in romance has always been recognized. Marvels are central to romance, and they're part of the reason why romance was supposed to lead to the novel, this kind of creating a fictive world that didn't need to obey the laws of nature. But, you know, as I show, a lot of the ways that romance writers talk about marvels is also how philosophers talked about marvels. And it's not like an easy separation between the false marvels of poetry and the true marvels of philosophy. But the marvels function a little differently. They don't need to be strictly possible or logically possible. They can be, you know, you can wink at the reader and say, let's pretend that this fairy is real. So one of the examples that I use is the fairy in the 14th century romance Melusine, who has special powers. She's able to see the future. She's able to shape certain events. She turns into a dragon or kind of a mermaid every Saturday from the waist down. And she tells her husband that she will continue to help him. Like, she can make him very prosperous. They can have a really like rich and happy life if he just leaves her alone on these Saturdays and doesn't peek. So he is left wondering whether she has these special powers to see the future because she's benevolent, because she's a fairy, or whether she's a bad kind of fairy or a demon. Because, you know, both of those groups were thought to have the ability to see the future and to know the past, other people's pasts. So he is sort of plagued by doubt and can't just accept the good fortune that he has and accept that she's benevolent. And so he peeks and that destroys everything. She ends up being a dragon permanently. She has to leave him and their children. And he wasn't willing to believe that the marvel was innocuous or even just beneficial to him. He had to understand how it worked. And so marvels often depend on others not scrutinizing them too carefully insofar as, you know, in the romance genre, you have to have faith in your beloved. And so if you really want to understand how the marvel works, like the philosophers do, then you kind of destroy the marvel and lose your beloved because you wanted to have certainty in an area where you were just supposed to have faith.
And another, let's say, to me, it was like a debunking thing, because I used to think of Marvel in terms of its magic and enchantment. But In the book, you talk about the role of Marvel in creating scrutiny and change rather than being simple enchantment. So that's, I guess, another part that our listeners would be interested to know more about.
I don't want to I don't want to argue against enchantment. I think it's a nice idea. I just think it's broader than it has been kind of considered to be. So, you know, enchantment doesn't need to be stupefaction. It can be, but it doesn't need to be just kind of paralysis or even kind of embarrassment. Sometimes when you are full of wonder, you're just kind of sitting there like, you're not really able to speak coherently. You might say a stupid thing. So I wanted to make room for intellectual inquiry, I guess, in the world of wonder and enchantment. I wanted to show that investing in the text and asking, who are we supposed to believe, say, in this scene where prophecy is really important, can add a lot to our investment in the text and to our own enchantment. Inquiry doesn't need to be, where we stop being enchanted by the text. Like, intellectual kind of engagement with literature doesn't need to distance us from it. So I did want to change the way that we define enchantment so that it can contain a much fuller range of responses to marvelous literature. It doesn't just need to be that we're like overwhelmed by them. It can also be, that the text teaches us how to think more intelligently about them and how to kind of distinguish what seems true from what actually is true, in Melusine, to distinguish between, the threat that magic might pose because you don't understand it, and the wonderment that it provides.
Before we come to the end of this interview, I always ask this question, if there's any other book or project you're currently working on? Is there any book we should soon expect?
Soon expect, no. It takes me about somewhere to 8 to 10 years, it seems, to write a book. But the new one's on hybrid animals. So it builds off of the Marvels in the sense that hybrid animals are also Marvels. But there's just an absolute obsession with them, especially actually in Arabic philosophy. Like, Jah is obsessed with hybrid animals. And I'm just super intrigued at this point to understand why there's such fascination with them. And also why, I mean, they knew how like mules and hinnies work. They knew that two animals, when they procreate, create a kind of synthetic third thing, but they still represent sirens as like women from the waist up and fish or birds from the waist down, and that kind of stitched together, two different animals that are stitched together. And they knew that that wasn't actually how hybridity worked. So I just want to come up with an explanation for the philosophy and the literature again, and its fascination with hybridity and like why that was such an interesting phenomenon to them.
Professor Michelle Carnes, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us on New Books Network.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you.